or Gessler or something like that. And my mother spoke to him. And she was a pacifist, my mother. She said, well, I'm so sorry that our two countries fought for so many years. We should never fight again. There should be peace on earth and blah, 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 blah. A lot of peace talk. And then my father said, my father didn't understand English at all. My father said, now, would you like to say something? You speak English too. So I said, yes, why not? And I said, I'm glad you were the first German I meet. Well, do you know, during the First World War, I was on your side, not on the side of the Allies. Not for any other reason, but because they are hypocrites. They say one thing, and they do another thing. I don't like them. And I really like you. And I wish one day you be the first nation, you conquer the whole of Europe, be the prominent people in Europe. I wish that. That would give a lesson to these people, the Allies. Don't like them. Repeated it 2 or 3 times. And he smiled, he didn't say a word. I wonder whether, during the Kampfzeit, during the struggle for power of Hitler, whether he thought of me sometimes, that 13-year-old girl that told him, I wish your country to be the leader of Europe. Anyhow, whether he did or whether he didn't, I don't know. But I would like to know whether he's alive still. He would be now, of course, I was 13, he might have been 20, 22. He must be not far from 80, more than 80 now if he's alive, because I'm in my 74th year. So that came, that was that. And I followed the movement of Hitler, well, with great sympathy, as the movement of a foreign leader working for his country, nothing more. But at the same time, under the influence of the Museum Musigime, where I was in touch with all the religions of Asia, and I like to study them. And I liked many of them. I liked Shinto, the national religion of Japan. I liked the idea of hierarchy that you find in Hindu religion. Idea of the whole race, all the races of the world represented in India, with the Aryan at the top. It's the only religion in the world that tells you that the Aryan is to be at the top of all other races. And that combined with Bible study, my mother sent me to a sort of Sunday school, and I learned a lot. I had an aunt also, a very pious aunt, admirer of the Jews as the God's own people. And she told me I must read in front of her every Sunday and every Sunday afternoon a chapter of the Old and a chapter of the New Testament. And I did so. And the reading of the Bible just put me against the Jews. I did not learn opposition to the Jews in Mein Kampf. I didn't read it till it was not published in those days. I learned opposition to the Jews in the Bible, nowhere else. In the Old Testament, especially. I told my aunt, why should I admire these people? You say that God chose them. What bad taste to choose these people? I would have better taste than that. I would have chosen the Greeks or the British or the Germans or what something else, but not or the Indians perhaps, but not these. Why? Well, they have ways of living that I don't like. For instance, here's a woman called Jael. It's in the 5th chapter of the Judges, I think. She is called in the Song of Deborah, in the Judges, she's called Blessed Woman, blessed among all women that live in tents. And she's the only one in the Bible called Blessed Among All Women, except the Blessed Virgin Mary, Mother of Christ. Why is she called Blessed Among All Women? Because after the Battle of Tanakh, when the Amalekites were fleeing in front of the Jews, and the head of the Amalekites, the general Sisera, in the desert, went to her tent, the tent of Jael, wife of Eber, the Kenite, and told her, I'm thirsty, give me water. I know what it means now, I've crossed the desert, to be thirsty in the desert. In those days, of course, I didn't know it, but still, I knew what it was to be thirsty. And she said, all right, come in my tent, and I'll give you water, not only water, I'll give you milk, and you can sleep there. And in he came, she gave him milk, she put him to sleep on something, on a carpet, say. And while he was asleep, says the Bible, I didn't invent it, she took one of those nails by which you fix the tent and hammer it through his head. And then she went out and called the Jews and said, come along, come along. I killed your enemies, Sisera, come and see him. And for that act of cowardice, she's called blessed among all women. I didn't like that. I said, that, if that's Jewish courage, well, thank you very much. I didn't also like the episode of Agag, king of the Amalekites, caught by, handed over to Samuel, the so-called prophet, and cut up alive into pieces on an altar of stone, a piece of stone. Why? Because Samuel had told, on the part of God, had told Saul, the king of the Jews, to spare no prisoners, kill them all, and the women, and the babies, and the cattle, kill every one of the Amalekites. And he didn't do it. He kept them as slaves, he kept the animals in order to eat them later on, and he kept Agag, and Samuel said, because you didn't listen to the command of God, you are no longer king of Israel from this minute. And where is Agag? Here he is, all right. He cut him to pieces all alive. I found that very nasty for a prophet. And I didn't like also the episode of David, the very good king, in Samuel 2, chapters 12, verses 35 and following, in which it is said that after the conquest of Rabbah, the capital of the Ammonites, he just put sword in two, some of the prisoners, had them sword in two, and the others were put alive in briquettes. Thank you very much. And moreover, these Ammonites were people of the same race as the Jews, more or less. They were the children of Ben-Ami, the son of one of Lot's daughters, who that is her own father, just as the Moabites were the sons of Moab, the son of another daughter of Lot with her own father. But they were Semites, and they were very close to the Jews, but they did not worship the Jewish God. That was the only difference. They worshipped Milcah, the Ammonites, and the Moabites worshipped Chemosh. What's the difference? Why should people quarrel over their gods? I didn't understand that at all. And I didn't like the chosen people. I said, why should they be chosen? And why should Christianity, that comes from them, why should it be the international religion? We had religions before. We had our own national religions. We were Hellenes. We were, say, a religion of the Romans. We had our Nordic religions in Germany, in Russia, in France, the Celts, the Druids, all that. I liked those old religions, and I wanted to go back to them. But I said, to be honest, I like something of the Byzantine Church. I like the chanting, and I like the ceremonies. I don't like the Christian values, but I do like the Orthodox Church. I must see the cradle of Christianity before I do anything. So, from Greece, in April 1929, I was preparing my second doctorate thesis in Greece, what they call the thèse complémentaire, the complementary one, the principal one I had not taken yet. I was a graduate of the French University of Lyon. I had a licence, what they call licence des lettres. And I joined a Greek pilgrimage to Palestine, third class. It was cheap, and we were to stay 40 days in Palestine. And what shocked me was the feeling, the contrast between the attitude of the co-Greek pilgrims in front of the Holy Land, bowing down to everything they could find that linked them with the days of Christ, and kissing the land as Holy Land, and behaving really in what I called a servile manner, because it was the Holy Land. And the foreign atmosphere of the land, I felt myself in quite different surroundings from those of Greece, of Europe, of course, but even of Greece, which is an Oriental European country. In Greek we say, I'm going to Europe when we go to Italy. Europe is considered as something different. Whatever was under Roman, Western Roman domination is Europe, whatever was under Byzantine Empire is not Europe to this day, in the Greek speech. So I looked at that and I said, well, Holy Land, what is a Holy Land? Holy Land for a Greek is Greece. Holy Land for a German is Germany. Why should Palestine be the Holy Land of the Greeks? Why should we call in Greek schools, Holy History, the history of the Jews? What is holy about it? And it dawned on me that the whole of Europe has been, for centuries, under the grip, the spiritual grip, of a foreign people. We go to the cathedrals, these beautiful cathedrals, and we see the Jewish prophets, Moses and all the others, along with the saints, and the saints are Jews, most of them, and some of course are not, but most of them are. All the first ones are, the apostles are. Well, Jesus is supposed to have been one. And why should we bow down to these? Why don't we bow down to our own people? We have philosophers. We don't need the fathers of the church. Well, in fact, the fathers of the church put a lot of Aryan philosophy into the Jewish tradition. But that's enough, another question. Why should we be under that grip? Who is going to free us from that grip? Who is going to give us our own self again? And it suddenly dawned on me, sometime in April 1939, and in Palestine of all places, that this foreign German leader that wanted all Germans in one state and wanted the abolition of the treaties of Versailles and Saint-Germain, that this one really wanted more than that, much more. And much more meaning the freedom of Europe, the freedom of the Aryan race from any kind of Jewish spiritual overlordship. Said, he's the one who wants, he's going to free us from that. Well, if it's that, then he's not only the German's leader, he's my leader too, mein Führer. And from that day, I felt not that I was becoming a National Socialist, I never became one, but that I had always been one without knowing it. That's what I felt. And I started thinking of going to Germany and joining the movement. It was the movement of liberation. But then, something else came into consideration. I had just taken Greek nationality officially when I was 21. I didn't believe that I should keep French nationality when I was more attached to Greece than I was to France. At the Greek Ministry of Home Ministry, Ministry of Interior, as they call it, they told me, you will have no advantage at all in taking Greek nationality because your diplomas are French, you did all your education in France you'd have a career, in Greece you'd have none. I said, I don't care. I shall not be the compatriot of Mr. Franck Lambouillon, who signed the secret, more or less secret, treaty with the Turks in 1921. Nor of the General Sarai, who landed in Salonika without permission of the Greek government in 1915. And it's all I want. They said, when you are old, and with no pension, no work, you'll regret it. Well, I am old now, and I'm sorry to say to those who told me the contrary, I do not regret it. I do not regret any act of sincerity. Anyhow, I thought in those days, I said, now if I go to Germany, they will say this woman was of French nationality at birth. She took Greek nationality when she was 21. What does she want now in Germany? Is she a kind of spy or something like that? There would be mistrust. So I thought to myself, no, I must start working in Greece itself for the old ideology, the old pagan ideology. And if I cannot there, I must go somewhere else. But I must only go to Germany when I have something to show, some achievement that I have had elsewhere. I'm not going to Germany before, especially not now, during the struggle. So I kept out of it. In Greece, I met with the opposition of the people that loved the church. You are going against the religion of our fathers. I told them, dear me, what do you mean by the religion of your fathers? If nobody in your family had ever gone against the religion of his fathers, that is to say the Olympian gods, you wouldn't be now a Christian. So, why do you blame me? Anyhow, I found after a year or two that I couldn't do nothing. I went back to France. I took a degree in science. I'm an MSc in chemistry, physics chemistry. And then I did my doctorate thesis, the first thesis, La Simplicité Mathématique, what is mathematical simplicity? And as a second subject, I took an essay on Theophilus Kairis, of 350 pages. Theophilus Kairis being a Greek born in 1784, died in prison in 1853 for not being in accordance with the Orthodox Church. And the real object of my thesis was not really the person of Kairis so much as the mentality of the modern Greek. The modern Greek condemned Kairis for not belonging, no, for repudiating the Orthodox Church, which was the national church. The ancient Greeks condemned Socrates because he does not believe in those gods in which the city believes. He's an Athenian, he should believe in the gods of Athens. He doesn't, well, out with him, he must drink poison. Hemlock. I said it's the same mentality. And to show the similarity of that mentality of modern Greeks and ancient Greeks, I wrote that thesis. And then, before writing my thesis, while I was still writing it, I felt that I should go somewhere and start something else. He says, start really a collaboration of something of today with the eternal spirit that Germany represented. And I thought of India. I said, India is a country of many races, but it's the only country in the world whose religion proclaims the Aryan race as the most excellent of all, and would give the leadership to the Aryans only, according to tradition. I don't mean to say that in India today the leadership is in the hands of Aryans, anything but. India was in those days under the British. I didn't know a single Indian. But one fine day, after the death of my father in 1932, in February 1932, I had a part of his inheritance, although a small part, just a quarter. My father was not really rich. It was in reality the money of my mother that belonged to my father, because she was married, what they call in French, without a contract. That is to say, without any money arrangement. The money was mine anyhow. I went to the British consul. I got a permit for India and sailed off to India, or let's say to Colombo, without knowing where I was going and what I would do there. I just had the money. The British consul told me it will last 3 months. Why? Because you have to travel first class, you are a European. I said, all right, those that want to keep up Europe's prestige by traveling first class, they can do so. I shall travel cheap to make my money last. And I went all over India, fourth class. There were four classes left. I didn't care. No ventilation, smelly wagons, didn't care, as long as I can see the country and see the temples. And I remember I left Ceylon. In Ceylon was my first experience with Buddhism. I went to a Buddhist temple in Kandy and put an offering in front of the Buddha, along with other women. I felt his beating of drums in my body. It was an exotic experience, which is something new. And some of these women were quite fair. After all, I said, well, Buddhism is really an Aryan religion. Originally, it was the foundation of an Aryan, which is something better than Christianity anyhow. And from there, after several days in Ceylon, about a fortnight, I went to Talamanar and Dhanushkodi in India. Talamanar is the Ceylon station, Dhanushkodi is the Indian station. And there, I went to the Rameshwaram temple. I went there on a festive day, and I saw in Rameshwaram temple the festival of Vaishakh Purnima, month of May. These series of elephants, seven elephants, one behind the other, with purple draperies, beautiful young, dark young men, like bronze statues holding them, in the darkness with a queer music, very, very peculiar music that I had never heard. And then suddenly, the procession all around the sacred tank, following the chariot of Rama and Sita. Rama and Sita being the king and queen of Ayodhya years and millennia ago. They were both Aryans. Rama and Sita, they were Kshatriyas, Aryans. And they conquered the south. They conquered the south, says the Indian legend, with the help of the monkeys. In reality, it means they conquered Dravidian strongholds, Dravidian power. The Dravidians were much more advanced than the Aryans, technically speaking. They conquered them with the help of the Aborigines. The Aborigines are pictured as monkeys. The king of the monkeys, Hanuman, gave his alliance to Rama. They conquered the south. And they took back Sita. Sita had been taken away by the king of the south, that is to say, Ravana. And I saw this crowd all around the sacred tank, under the full moon, with one palm tree at the background, a violet sky, beautiful, and this crowd throwing flowers of jasmine and other flowers on the chariot of Rama and Sita. The crowd of dark people, Dravidians, dark people honoring the Aryan conqueror, represented white, as well as his wife, in the chariot, honoring him with praise, with flowers, with a whole ceremonial, thousands of years after the conquest. And I stood against a pillar, and I thought of the song, the German song of those days, Deutschland gehört uns morgen, heute, und morgen die ganze Welt. Germany belongs to us today, and tomorrow the whole world. And I thought, today the whole world. Here you are, non-Aryans in crowds, come and worship as a god, an Aryan king of old. That's lovely. I was proud of my race, proud of myself, proud of being a National Socialist. And I said to myself, one day I'll preach National Socialism to these people, to the elite of them, at least to the Aryans, and see what happens. They might be our allies. At least the religion is our ally. It's the only religion in the world that's perfectly compatible. And even, I mean to say, of the living religions, I don't speak of the ancient pagans, the living religions, it's compatible with our Weltanschauung absolutely. And I went further north. From temple to temple, I visited quite a lot of India. I remained in Pondicherry for one time or two. I gave a lecture in Pondicherry. I don't know how much it was appreciated anyhow. I went up north. And I reached Bengal. And I stayed in Bengal some time. And I went back to Europe. But just for a very, very short time in 1935. Why? Just to do my soutenance de thèse, is to say, to take my doctorate degree. And a job was waiting for me on my return after I would know Hindi. A job in Jalandhar College to teach history of England and history of India. But that was to be in 36. Before that, I had to learn Hindi thoroughly. So I came back from Europe and I went to Shantiniketan in Bengal to learn Hindi and to perfect my Bengali. I had learned Bengali thoroughly. So in Shantiniketan, what happened? I knew the great poet Rabindranath Tagore. I didn't know that he was surrounded by all sorts of people, some of them former missionaries and some of them Jews. I didn't know that his teacher of German was a Jewess from Berlin called Margaret Spiegel, that had been 2 years in the surroundings of Gandhi, telling Gandhi, of course, during these 2 years that there was nothing more opposed to his non-violence as National Socialism, trying to drag him away from all these kind of things. And the secretary of Rabindranath Tagore thought it good to introduce me to Margaret Spiegel. I was introduced. But you can imagine that after half an hour's conversation in 1935, when even if it were in 1945, I would have found it out, but all the more in 1935, she at once found out who I was. And I didn't mind telling her, in fact. I couldn't care less. In 35, I always had a place to go if I was not happy in one place. And she said to me, look here, I came here not to see the shadow of a Nazi any longer, not even the shadow of one. And I come here and I see you, and do you know that you are worse than the whole pack, all in one? I said, why am I worse than the whole pack, all in one? That's a great honor. He said, because they speak of the whole world. Germany belongs to us today, but tomorrow the whole world. They never think of the whole world. They only think of their blessed Germany. You think of the whole world. And you want the elite of India to be your ally. I said, this is exactly what I want. You want to conquer India. I said, I want to conquer Aryan India. There are Indians who are perfectly white and Aryan, and there are some that are a little bit darker, They're still Aryan. They're not any darker than southern Europeans, and lighter than some southern Europeans. In those days, I didn't know Mr. Mukherjee yet. I was far from suspecting his existence. But I knew a paper called The New Mercury that was published in Calcutta by A.K. Mukherjee. And that paper was the only Hitler paper in India. It was a cultural and somewhat political, but more cultural than anything else, magazine. There were articles in it, like the history of the swastika, like an article from the Führer himself, recopied, Nation and Architecture. More other articles showing the homeland of the Aryans, and this and that. I used to read it with delight. And the ordinary newspapers were more and more anti-German. That is to say, from the landing of Jews in India in 1933, the money that they gave to the papers made the press slowly turn. And from 1937 onwards, it was completely on the other side. There were stories of Nazi atrocities, or Nazi pressure, tyranny and whatnot, on the poor Jews. And people talked to it. And I used to say, well, the poor Jews did so many things in the Old Testament that they have no time for them. The atrocities in the Old Testament are much worse. Oh, that was a thousand years ago, thousands of years ago. I said, it doesn't matter to me. It's all the same. Time doesn't count for me. Anyhow, I used to read this paper with delight. And one day I told some Greeks that I knew, Greek family I used to frequent, could not I not meet that gentleman that edits this paper? They said, yes, he was a neighbor of ours once. We can introduce you. And I was introduced to Mr. Mukherjee on the 9th of January, 1938. And when I told him I was in Shantiniketan once, he said, oh, you are the person whom I refused to meet in 1935. I said, you refused to meet me? He said, yes. I didn't know you. Somebody just told me that there was a Greek woman in Shantiniketan who had more or less my ideas. And I said, she cannot have my ideas. And why did she come in that case? Why did she come to that Jewish nest, Shantiniketan? Why didn't she go somewhere else? She must be really a Jewess out of the ghetto of Salonika. And I said, of course I wasn't that. He said, I know it now. I can see it now. But why did you go to that place, Shantiniketan? I said, because it was cheap. £1.50, and you were staying there, living there, with all the expenses for 6 months. And I had not much money. I went there to learn Hindi. All right, I know it now. I'm very sorry I couldn't meet you then. Anyhow, we had a talk. We had a long talk. And I saw in him a person who really had our ideas, not because he was directly Hitlerian, but he was Hitlerian because he was an Orthodox Brahmin. And he saw in our Weltanschauung, he saw the Western, if you like, edition of his own philosophy. His philosophy putting the Aryan race above others, and the idea of hierarchy of all races under the Aryan. And I liked it, and we became quite friendly. He had just given up the New Mercury, that is to say, the New Mercury was confiscated. He had no copies of it. It was forbidden by the British, according to the change of their policy in 1937. And he was the editor of a Japanese paper for Japanese interests, the Eastern Economist. And he put me in touch with that. And I wrote a couple of articles for that, an article on Shinto and another one on one of the episodes of Japanese history of the 14th of August, 1281, when the Japanese fleet was, the Tata fleet of Kublai Khan was destroyed near the coast of Japan, wanting to attack Japan. And we became friends, but nothing more. Very good co-fighters. We had the same ideas. And he told me, one of his first words were, you go back to Europe. There will soon be war. And you'll be much more useful over there than you are here. But the damn fool I was, I thought myself useful in India. I was working for the Hindu mission. The Hindu mission was an organization fighting Christian missionaries, fighting Islamic missionaries, fighting communism, fighting anything that was against Hindu tradition, Aryan tradition. And when I had met the head of the Hindu mission, the founder of it, Satyananda Swami, I told him, look here, I'm a European pagan. I'm a disciple of Hitler. Can I talk my own talk in my lectures? He wanted to employ me as a lecturer. He said, you can talk whatever you like. I consider your Hitler as an incarnation of the gods, at least of God Vishnu, who is the god that keeps the world in place against the destruction, against decadence. I honor him. You can talk about him as much as you like. Only you must talk about him from the Indian point of view. You must interest the Indians in him. I said, all right. And I did that. In my speeches, in the name of the Hindu mission, I used to quote Mein Kampf. I used to quote the myth of Heisenberg, you know, the 20th century myth. I used to quote quite a number of things. And I used to tell them that there was a movement in Europe in favor of the original Aryan values, just as there are in India people that stick up for the Aryan values. And I was quite pleased, and I thought I was useful. I was a damn fool. I thought, who is going to make quotations out of Mein Kampf if I go away? As if this was important. Making quotations of Mein Kampf in Bengali or in Hindi, in Bihar, in Bengal, in Assam. I had the three provinces under my jurisdiction, but I would say I was to travel among these three provinces. Who is going to do that if I go away? I thought that important. I repeat, for the third time, I was a damn fool. And I didn't go to Germany. I said, I'll go it all. And I'll show the Führer the few things I'm trying to do in India. I wanted to tell him, the Führer, I am bringing you the alliance of the elite of India. I wanted to let him do it, to tell him that. If the war had turned different, perhaps I could have been able to tell him that. I don't know. Anyhow, I didn't go. And the war came, declaration of war. And one day Mr. Mukherjee came to me with a poster, war, W-A-R. He said, what are you going to do now? I said, I'd so much like to go to Europe now. Well, he said, I'll try to arrange with the Italian consul, who was his best friend, to send you to Europe, send you first to Italy, and then to Germany. And we'll arrange for you to speak in Bengali. They have somebody for Hindi. But do you know Bengali even better than Hindi? In Bengali and in modern Greek, to speak on the German radio, war propaganda. I said, I'd be delighted. Under Goebbels, I'll be delighted. And Goebbels will probably introduce me to the Führer one day or another. I was delighted. Of course, I'd have to renew my passport. My passport was exhausted. And for convenience, of course, it would be better if I had an Indian passport. Anyway, for not only for this convenience, but they were interning in those days all the people that were against the British war effort. And Mr. Mukherjee told me, everybody knows in the secret places. He was in touch with the secret police himself through some Bengalis who were working for it. Everybody knows that you are against the British war effort, you are for Hitler. You'll be interned automatically. They are interning so many people. The only way not to be interned is to take an Indian name and an Indian nationality. If you like, I'll give you my name. And that's how we married. We just married in that way. We married a civil marriage, and after that we had a religious ceremony, a Hindu ceremony, because I had adhered to Hinduism long before I met him, so there was no trouble in that. And we married, and we went he to his house and I to my house. In the end, after several months, we took a flat, four rooms. We had each one our two rooms, and we were like friends. We used to meet now and then. To discuss things, to read books together, and that was all. The rules of Hinduism are very strict. Orthodox Hinduism, they are very strict concerning marriage. A Hindu Brahmin is not allowed to marry even a Brahmin of his province if that Brahmin is not of the same subcaste, Sreni, as himself. He is to marry outside his gotra and inside his Sreni. That was, of course, not my case. And if he doesn't, he marries somebody else. Well, he should not have any children. He should not found a family like that. You don't found a family in India. You enter a family that's already existing for centuries. You continue a family. And you cannot continue a family if you are not of the proper caste. So we decided not to have any family at all. And not to have any family at all means no intimacy at all. And we kept up to it. We kept up to it to the very end. Because we believe in that. We believe that the forces that God has given us for continuing our families, for giving children of our race to the world, are not meant for a pastime, not an entertainment. They are not, I would say, superfluous for forces that should be wasted. Either they should be used for the divine purpose or not used at all. So, we became friends, and we remained friends. And we lived under the same roof, each one in our two rooms, seeing each other now and then, for all the time up till the end of 45, when I went back to Europe. Now, we had to do something during the war. We couldn't stay like that. We wanted to help Germany, we wanted to help Hitler. It was very difficult to help Adolf Hitler during the war. He was far away, all the Germans were gone. But there were some, there were the allies of Adolf Hitler, the Japanese that were on the spot. And Mr. Mukherjee was the right hand of the Japanese consul in Calcutta. He was very, very friendly. He was, in fact, the only foreign person, the only non-Japanese that I ever met, in whom the Japanese had full confidence. They didn't have any confidence in me. Oh no, I was a white woman. I was nothing. I happened to be his wife. All right. They had no objection to that. Women are not in Japan. But at least women like me, not Japanese women. Japanese women, there are some very celebrated ones in Japanese history. But they had no confidence in me. Till 1945, in fact, till 1949, till I proved that I was on their side and on Hitler's side. For the time being, they just were friendly with him, and he knew that they were going to attack Burma, they were going to come nearer to India, and our dream was they will enter India through the east, and the Germans, after the attack on Russia, will enter through the northwest, and then meet in Delhi. And in Delhi, in the Red Fort, the Führer will be proclaimed Weltführer. That was my dream, that was his dream too. The war rolled on. Burma was the first target. The Japanese were in Burma from 1941, 1942. They conquered Burma. The Americans and British fought against them. Now, during the whole war, we got Americans in our house. We got in touch with Americans. I used to bring them from some club. It was for them and for the British. The club had a name to teach them understand Indian ways, to eat with their fingers, curry, and other Indian dishes, to know something about astrology, something about yoga, something like that. So I used to go to the club with a nice sari and my big swastika earrings. Swastika is also an Indian symbol. It's an Aryan symbol. In fact, a Neolithic symbol for all Aryans in that time, those days. And the Americans would look at the queer earrings and say, why are you wearing that? I said, that's an Indian religious symbol. My husband's an Indian. Why doesn't he come to the club? I said, because you see, he's very orthodox. He won't eat things that are cooked differently from what he's accustomed to. He won't eat cakes. There are eggs in them and this and that. He doesn't come. Can we see him? I said, well, what do you want to see him for? He must be an interesting man. I said, yes, a very interesting man. He does yoga, and he's a very good astrologer. Oh, a good astrologer. We go to see him. Every week I had a jip full, or two jips full of Americans. He used to bring them to our house. Now, my brother-in-law, was superintendent of excise. He gave us whiskey. I never touched it, of course, I never touched alcohol in my life. I don't like it, I don't like the smell of it. But anyhow, he took the whiskey. We used to distribute whiskey to them. And talks. And I was never present at the talks. At most, I would tell them, you can see my cats. I have a number of cats in my room. I love all felines, cats and leopards and tigers and lions, whatever you like. They would say, oh, so many cats. Good, good, good. And are you interested in anything? What are you interested in? Interested in the war? I said, not at all. I'm interested in antiquity and cats. And in fact, I was writing a book on Akhenaten of Egypt in those days. Antiquity. So he talked with them. I never was present at the talks. But I know the Americans were delighted with his talk. They thought he was the best Democrat in the world. They presumed, without asking him, he never asked them, they presumed he must be anti-Nazi. And they started talking. And when they had eaten and drunk, they talked a lot, some of them. The most talkative, funny enough, some of the best ones for giving information were top-ranked Jewish officers in the American army. I remember one that gave us very good information. And the information would go to four Indians that used to cross the Burmese frontier every fortnight or so, and go straight to Yamagata's headquarters and give the information to Yamagata, the head of the Japanese in Burma. And like that, quite a number of things happened in Burma that were unexpected. Some top secret aerodromes were blown to pieces. Some units of the Allies were encircled and to surrender. Anyhow, Burma was conquered. And the Japanese entered India and into Imphal. And when they were in Imphal, we thought, now they're going up to Delhi. They didn't go, unfortunately. Anyhow, I'll always remember Mr. Mukherjee coming one day to my room when it was over midnight and telling me, so-and-so, an American Jew, has just told me that aerodrome that we spoke the other day, near Mitkinan, it has been set up into the air, bombed to pieces. I said, very good. He said, yes, and you told me that I was wrong in calling in front of that Jew, in calling Goering that fat baggy, that fat sack. If I had not showed him that kind of disposition, he never would have told me anything about the aerodrome. So I suppose Goering wouldn't mind to be called in a joking manner to an American Jew, fat bag, if that's the result. What do you think? I said, I think you're a diplomat. I said, you must be a diplomat. If you cannot use force of arms, you must use force of diplomacy. What can you do in the wartime? We can't support the Führer directly. We must support him through his allies. And so that's what we did. Anyhow, the war turned badly. We expected it to turn well, it turned badly. We expected Stalingrad to fall. And while the Battle of Stalingrad was on, I remember Mr. Mukherjee sipping Greek coffee that I had prepared for him in our house, sitting next to me and telling me, look here, you have seen the Khyber Pass, the way of conquerors, these great red blood red rocks, and ochre rocks and white rocks, all sorts of rocks, it's not a blade of grass, that go from Afghanistan to India. Yes, in 1936, I went through the Khyber Pass myself. It's a beautiful place. Wild. He said, imagine them now. Imagine the German army coming right through them. Imagine the echoing of the tanks. And imagine the song. Wir werden weiter marschieren, wenn alles in Scherben fällt. Heute gehört uns Deutschland und morgen die ganze Welt. That song in the Khyber Pass. They are the third wave, he told me. First wave, the first Aryans that came to India. Although there were several waves, they were not one. They came from the northwest. And second, the troops of Alexander. And third, this is the third wave. I said, yes, wonderful. Wonderful. And they'll meet in, with the Japanese, with their allies, they'll meet in Delhi, and in Delhi there'll be a big ceremony at the Red Fort, and our Führer will be Welt Führer. I'm going to buy a sari to wear on that day. And I went and bought a beautiful silk sari with a border of silver swastikas, as big as that, 10 centimeters all around the border. And I didn't wear it yet, I was going to wear it at the Red Fort only, when the Führer comes. But I showed it to my mother-in-law. And my mother-in-law, an Orthodox Hindu, knowing more than I do about the right spirit of things, she said, "You are not ashamed of yourself. You, a disciple of Adolf Hitler, to buy such a thing." I said, "Why?" He said, "But a sari will drag on your feet. The border will touch your feet. Isn't it a shame that the holy sign, the swastika, will touch your feet? That shouldn't be done. It's an insult to the holy sign." And she was right from the Hindu point of view. You should never have a holy sign on a sari border, because the sari border touches one's feet. It's not right. So I said, "All right, I won't wear it. I'll buy something else." She said, "Buy something else with a different pattern. The swastika, the holy swastika, must not touch your feet." Anyhow, that sari I took back to Europe. It was stolen from me in 1946, with many other saris. In my suitcase, stolen in the station in the palace, Salazar station. In the meantime, things went on, the war went worse and worse. Worse and worse. Whatever we did, it was useless. We felt it was useless. So, in 1944, October 44, I had enough of it. I didn't want to know when the capitulation would come. So I left my cats in charge of Mr. Mukherjee and of the servant. We had a very reliable, good servant. And I took the train for the south. I left Calcutta. And I traveled all to all sorts of sacred places and temples and places where I had no risk of meeting anybody. I didn't want to know when the capitulation would come. I saw on my way, I saw awful things. I was in a train between, I don't remember what place, and Tiruchendur in the south of India once. And there was a gentleman in the same compartment. And he was holding a newspaper in English. And I read upside down the head of his, the headline of his paper, "Berlin is an inferno." I felt cold. And anyhow, I went through small towns. And I kept to temples, and I kept to the Hindus, not concerned with politics. I avoided newspapers, and I didn't know when the capitulation came. I knew it 3 weeks later. I was in a place called Sringeri, on the western coast, or rather, on the Ghats, looking over the western coast. It's a very celebrated place. It's the birthplace of one of the greatest Indians of all times, Sankaracharya of the 8th century. The one who wiped out Buddhism from India and restored the old Aryan values of Hinduism. Buddhism was caste, you see. Hinduism is not. And I went in a cafe there to have a cup of coffee. I was staying at the Dak Bungalow, place for tourists. And in the cafe, there were two men from Hyderabad. Two Mohammedans. Mohammedans or not, I don't know. Anyhow, they were speaking Urdu. I don't know the language, Telugu. I don't know the language of Sringeri, the language of any language of the south, in fact, any of the Dravidian languages. But I can understand Urdu. And they were saying, "It's 3 weeks already since in Europe the fight is finished." So I knew it was finished. And I felt very cold. I didn't even finish my coffee. I felt very depressed. And on my way back, in one of the stations of South India, there was no place, at any place where they have rooms for tourists. I was tired, I went and slept in the grass outside the station. And a policeman came, "Hey, my G, Uto, old mother, you get up." He gave me a kick to kick me up. And I got up, but I was angry. I looked at his number and I went to report him. His manners mishandled me as he gave me a kick. And he won't allow me to sleep in the grass. I don't know where to sleep. There was, of course, a kind of place for women, with women and children and babies crying and radio going on. I couldn't sleep there. I told him so. His chief came and said to me in front of him, "Is it this man?" I said, "Yes, it's this man. Shall I dismiss him? He has 8 children." I said, "No, don't dismiss him. Not because he has 8 children, I couldn't care less how many children he has, but because I cannot dismiss the responsible people for this catastrophe in Europe. Why should I? Why should I bear a grudge to this people? He's just a small man. He is not responsible for anything except for kicking me. Let him kick me, it doesn't matter. I deserve it. I deserve it because I'm on the defeated side. We shouldn't be defeated. And please don't dismiss him at all. The one I would like to dismiss is Roosevelt. He was dead already. Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, these people. I can do nothing against them. Why should I do anything against the poor man?" That's what I answered. And the man was so grateful to me. Sam, so grateful to me. Yeah, it was a big family, depending on me. I said, all right. You are just the one man among millions. And I went back to Calcutta in July 45. I am all the end of 44, all the beginning of 45 till July, I was traveling in different parts of India, all alone, trying not to know what was happening in Europe. So I entered the house and Mr. Mukherjee opened the door. And the first thing I told him in Bengali, "Ki khobor, what is the news?" And he said, "Ki khobor, char zone, 4 zones, that's all. Germany cut into 4. And we both felt very depressed. He said to me, "Don't feel so depressed, because it has to go on. Things have to turn. This is the dark age, this is Kali Yuga, the dark age. What they call the worst age in the succession of 4 ages. You can't expect anything better. But after Kali Yuga, the Redeemer, the one who is to put an end to this succession of ages, Kalki, he must come. He couldn't come until his forerunner is Adolf Hitler. He couldn't win the war because he was nothing but the forerunner. He wasn't the one. He said so himself, he said. Actually, he did. He told on Sanskrit, "I'm not the one who is to come. I'm only his forerunner. I'm preparing the most urgent work. That's all, to prepare his coming. And you'll live and see the rest." I said, I wish I had been in Europe and I would have died now. He said, "Probably you're destined to live. Everybody mustn't die. If everybody in the movement dies, then there's no more movement." All right. Then, what happened afterwards? August, September, October came. There was the yearly festivals, Durga festival and the Kali festival. Kali is the dark goddess, dark blue goddess. We call her also Shyama, the dark blue one. She is supposed to represent the strength behind the Shiva entity, that is to say, the destroyer. Destroyer and creator. He is destroyer and creator, but all the gods have a Shakti, a female entity next to them, we call the consort of the god, and she is the energetic side. So, Kali, dark blue, with 4 arms, 2 arms holding one a sword and one a cut off head, and the 2 other arms blessing. She is the author of earthquakes, the author of volcanoes, the author of all that's destructive, and at the same time, she makes the corn grow. She's the universal mother. There's a great festival under her in October. First of Durga, and then of her. I went to both festivals. And she's the avenger. And I remember myself, I took part in the festival like a frantic person. The women smear their hands and faces with red and purple on that occasion. I smeared myself too, it is what they did. And I can see myself still in the Kalighat temple in Calcutta, in front of the statue, with the drums beating and resounding in me. And I would tell you, the Nuremberg trial was on at that time. It was must have been in November. It had just begun, or it was going to begin. Mother, dark blue mother, avenged them. Avenged them, the martyrs of Nuremberg, because those that are going to be, I knew they were going to be killed. Avenge all those that they are going to now oppress. A terrible time is coming, but help us to come out of it. And that idea of the dark blue mother that followed me all through my years in Europe. I'll explain that just now. Anyhow, end of 45, I went back to Europe. I gave my cats in charge to some friend I knew, a very good man, that was living at the barracks in Alipur. He told me I'll distribute them in the kitchens of the barracks. They'll have more than enough to eat and drink. Two of them, out of the 20 or 30 I had, two of them Mr. Mukherjee kept, and I left. Why did I leave? It was a heartbreaking to me to leave my cats, and to leave Mr. Mukherjee also. But I wanted to see Europe again, and I wanted to take part in whatever resistance there could be. I wanted to show my defiance against the victors, at any cost. I said, I'm going to. I just scribble on the walls, I distribute papers, I do what I can, but I must go. But I couldn't go to Germany. To go to Germany, I could have gone to Germany if I had been one of the followers of De Gaulle, for instance, or something like that. I could have worked with the Allies. But being what I am, I couldn't go. Directly, anyhow. I said, all right, I'll go to England, and from England I'll go. Or I'll go to France, and from there I'll go. I'll manage. So I went to England. I went to England, and the first thing I saw in Oxford Street, there are other things I saw, but I told, and one of the episodes of my first landing in England, I told in my cat book, Long Whiskers and the Two-Legged Goddess. I don't know if you have that book. I think Mr. Sunder has it. It's a story. It's a true story. It's 15 years of my life in connection with cats. It's called The True Story of a Most Objectionable Nazi and Half a Dozen Cats. Anyhow, that episode I've related in that book. So I let it alone now. The second episode I saw was a streamer across Oxford Street. Nazi atrocities, 1.5 shilling entrance. They were showing photographs, so-called photographs, propaganda. I didn't go in, naturally. I wasn't going to spend one and a half shilling for nothing. You see, it's nonsense. And even if it were true, I couldn't care less. I lived in England. Wherever I went, the radio, I didn't listen to radio, I never listened to it, I never had a radio nor a television set, and I don't want one. But when I went to people's houses, I had to listen to the radio, I had to hear it. The same old stuff all the time, all the time. And on my way back, on my way home, on the ship already, the denazification, the re-education of Germany, the reintegration of the German people in the community of Christian nations, and all such kind of things. I hated it. If I had not felt that perhaps one day the victors would be even in a worse plight than I saw my comrades, I would have thrown myself into the sea from the top deck. But I couldn't do it, because I thought to myself, one day you might see better, you might see the revenge. And ever since then, the end of the war, I would say, and especially wherever I went, my two main occupations were feeding cats, feeding stray animals, especially cats, and gloating over any nasty thing that might happen to any of the victims of 1945. So I landed in England and I got disgusted. And after a very short time, I said, I must go to France, at least to see my mother again. I didn't know anything about her, just a card and a word now and then. I went to France only to know that my mother had been in the French resistance. And that separated. I loved her deeply until then, But that separated us forever. That separated us completely. Although, I said to myself, she has given me my Viking blood. She's a descendant of the Vikings of Jutland, North Denmark. First of our family came to England in the 10th century. According to, they were not even Christians when they first came over. They were worshippers of Odin and Thor. And I have that blood. Why did she go into that nasty organization of witchcraft? Why did she allow herself to be taken? Pity for the poor Jews. And that put me against them even more. Anyhow, I didn't stay long. I went back to England. And as soon as I possibly could, I thought to myself, I'll go to Iceland. Iceland is a faraway place. I won't hear anything of this nonsense again. And on the 8th of November, 46, I sailed to Iceland from Halle. I had no money except £25. The boat cost £20. I landed in Reykjavik with £5. The room at the Borg Hotel costed £5. I could stay one day, or rather one night, even without the breakfast. So I went to the Salvation Army. Where should I go? And I told the Salvation Army that I came here to learn Icelandic, and I'm interested in the language, and I'd like to get a job. And they said, we have no job, unfortunately, not for you, with your doctorate and your MSc and MA degrees. Only job we have is a job of a maid servant in a farm, some miles from Reykjavik, to wash the plates. I said, give me that job. He said, you'll have your afternoons free. You'll be able to learn Icelandic in the afternoons. So I went, and I washed plates for a month in an Icelandic farm. I picked up a little Icelandic, not much, of course. And I continued picking it up. I continued reading my grammar. I mean, say, improving as much as I could. I admired the Nordic type of the Icelanders. Beautiful people. Beautiful people. And to think that so many of them were on the other side, against all I stand for, that put me out. But they were beautiful. And one day I had a call. The Icelandic farmer, the telephone, Iceland is extremely modern now. Very well equipped. And the phone came from an Icelander of Reykjavik, telling me he has an Austrian wife. He would like me to live in a room he would give me for nothing. Only condition was that I would speak French with his Austrian wife. I said, all right, I came home. The dog of the farm followed me during the 10 miles, all through the snow. I caressed the dog, and he even came to the home of this Icelander. And he had something to eat and went back. I stayed there. I stayed there nearly a year. I saw the eruption of the Hekla, Mount Hekla. On the 29th of March, 47, it started. And it lasted practically a whole year. I went to see it on the 4th of April, and I spent the night of the 5th of April on the slopes of the erupting volcano. I wanted to spend the first night there, but the people that were with me took my clothes and I had to go down again too, because I couldn't stay the whole night. Snowy night with no clothes, no overcoat. Second night I went up by myself, 11 o'clock at night, up the volcano. I went up to 1 kilometer about from the big crater. There were five small craters and two big ones. And I admired it. Imagine a snowy landscape of silver. I suppose you have the same in Canada. Must be looking the same. The full moon over that. In a violet sky, and in front of the full moon, a panache of volcanic ash, volcanic smoke, black, as black as it can be, and hanging in the sky, beautiful northern lights, green and purple, greenish yellow, moving like that, and purple fringe. It was beautiful. I was in front of the lava stream. The lava of the Hekla Mount is an acid lava. It contains 60 to 65% of silicates. It is thick. It doesn't run like water, like the Vesuvius lava or like the Stromboli's lava. It takes time to walk. walks a few meters per day. And the top of it is with a crust as thick as about 5 centimeters, perhaps more. And when that breaks under the pressure of boulders from inside, it makes a queer noise, like broken crockery. I was there, going up and down along the stream for the whole night. And I wanted to go around the stream and go nearer to the crater. But some scientists that were there told me, don't do that, because the two lava streams might come into one, and you'll be in an island surrounded with lava. You won't be able to come out. So I avoided doing that. Suddenly, flames came in there. 2-3 places. New, tiny little craters. I fled, of course. But all the time, what impressed me was the roaring of the volcano, like the original sound Om. That is, in Hindu tradition, they say the original sound of creation is Om. When the volcano says, every 2 or 3 seconds, Om, Om, Om. And the earth is trembling under your feet all the time. Anyhow, I waited, I saw the sunrise over that beautiful landscape. And I tried to come down. Instead of coming down, I lost myself. And I had in my hands a big slice of lava. I had some small ones too, but I had a big one, about 10 or 15 kilos. There was a boulder that flamed itself out of the lava stream in front of me, and it came rushing in front of my face at about 15 or 10 centimeters from my face. Then if it had hit me, I wouldn't be here to speak. And then it went cold, and when it became cold, I took a slice, took a big piece, and carried it about. I said, I'm going to give that to some friends when I come back. But it was heavy, and I was getting exhausted. And at one time, I couldn't find my way back. Absolutely couldn't find my way back. I saw him weeping out of desperation. I said, well, it cost the river to come here. Where's the river? At the end, I found a river. I went down. And I left the big boulder alone. I couldn't carry it any longer. And then I saw somebody on the back of the river. I saw 2 children. I called them. They ran away at my sight. And I saw the man. And I asked him, I said, the so-and-so farm, the farm from which I had started, where is it? He said, over here, around the corner. You go down and you turn left, it's around the corner. I got back to my farm. And I looked at myself in the looking glass. When I saw myself in the looking glass, I understood why the children fled. My face was black with volcanic ash and smoke, absolutely black. And my eyes were red, there was volcanic ash in them, and they were aching, and tears in the black, white tears in the black. I looked off, and I couldn't quite understand. Anyhow, I washed my face. And sat down, I had a cup of coffee, I had a piece of bread and butter. And the day passed on, and I went back to the place where I was staying, a few miles away from the volcano. But that was a unique experience. I love volcanoes. I would like to, if I had money and opportunity, I'd like to see all the volcanoes of the earth. I'd like to hear the Chimborazo and the Cotopaxi of the equator. I'd like to hear the roaring. See the lava streams. I'd love this. I remember an expression that was familiar to us in school about the Pacific Ocean, la ceinture de feu du Pacifique, the far belt of the Pacific, Japan, Alaska, South America, all around that. I'd love to see them, but I only saw 3 in my life. I don't know if I'll ever live long enough to see another one. Anyhow, in the summer of that year, I had a few pupils. I lived in Iceland. I got to learn Icelandic. I used to speak fluently. It's a language that's very akin to German. And when I knew Icelandic and could hear the radio and could hear people speak, I thought it was no better than England. It was not worth changing. Only the landscape was worth it. But the mentality of the people was just the same stupid anti-Nazi mentality. fed on propaganda, and fed on reaction to anything that hurts human beings. I wouldn't say I was never taken in by the propaganda. No, I believed it, as a damn fool I probably was. I believed it all. The 6 million Jews, I believed it till I read the Book of Bus. But I didn't care. I didn't care because I had my love of animals that protected me. I said, as long as man commits such atrocities on animals in the name of science, in the name of sport, in the name of eating, in the name of whatever you like, fur industry, I have no time for atrocities on human beings, especially on enemies. I don't care what happens to them. Finished. That was my reaction. It is not the reaction of the average two-legged mammal. So the average two-legged mammal was anti-Nazi, and I was not. I could never be. I'm not against today. I'm not making a fuss about, say, a man like Amin Dada in Africa. Especially when Amin Dada says he admires Hitler. I'm not very flat. A Negro admiring Hitler, I'm not very enthusiastic about that. He wouldn't be enthusiastic about it if he were alive. But anyhow, better be an admirer of his than an enemy. And he says that he was a very remarkable man, and he would even like to erect a statue to him in Uganda. All right. Anyhow, what he does to his own Ugandan compatriots, I couldn't care less. I couldn't care. And the same thing for the Jews. When they used to tell me 6 million, I said, pity it's not 16 million. If it was 16 million, your question would be solved already long ago. That's all my answer was. Whatever it is.